Hello, everybody. My name is Sharon Hillier. I'm from the University of Pittsburgh and McGee Women's Research Institute and the Microbicide Trials Network. I want to thank everyone who's joined us today, and hopefully we'll get a few more people coming in to this jointly sponsored satellite symposium called Minor Issues, Major Consequences. This is led by the International Partnership for Microbicides, the AVAC, and the Adolescent Trials Network. And we're really, really excited about tackling what we think are really enormous issues with the involvement of adolescents in clinical trials. I'd like to introduce my co-panelist, Connie Kellum. You'll notice that each of you have on your seats the full bios for each of the participants in this, so we won't bore you with reading those aloud to you, and we'll count on you reading those to yourself in case you're worried about who any of us are. So with that, I'd like to introduce Connie, and she'll be introducing our first speaker.
Great. Thank you, Sharon. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Linda Gail Becker, who is known to many of you and has really been a champion of this issue of adolescence, both from a research but also a service delivery perspective. She is the Chief Operating Officer at the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation and Professor of Medicine at University of Cape Town, and is one of the most articulate spokespersons on this topic. So thank you, Linda Gail.
Thanks very much, Connie and Sharon, for allowing me to do this. And you'll notice also from your programs that we've got really short chunks of time, so I'm just going to get on and present what I wanted to share with you, and my task was really to set the scene from an epi point of view. So I would contest that we really need an urgent prevention revolution, and in the next few slides I want to just hit home why that is. Today's generation of young people is the largest in human history. It makes up about a quarter of the world's population and a third of Africa's population. Indeed, we do have on our hands an urgent and ongoing crisis. There are about 2,500 infections every day. That translates into one new infection every 30 seconds, and 80% of these occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Again, this amounts to about 2.1 million adolescents between the ages of 10 and 19 living with HIV worldwide, and again, two-thirds of those are in girls. This is data from 2012 and thanks to UNICEF. And when you look to see where those areas are that this is mostly concentrated, you see it's South and East Africa and Southeast Asia. So this has resulted in an unacceptable inequality, with AIDS deaths rising among adolescents. And this is the only age group that has actually seen an increase in deaths over the last couple of years, unlike all other populations where we've actually begun to see the trajectory turn, now resulting in being the second leading cause of death in any population worldwide. So again, thanks to UNAIDS for this slide, and Susan Cassetti showed it last year in Melbourne, and it really, I think, is stark. New HIV infections in adolescents in 20 countries with the highest number of new HIV infections. And it really differentiates the population into two. One being young women in the sort of pink zone, which is largely predominantly young women in Africa. And then the yellow zone, which is largely key populations, most of them men who have sex with men in other parts of the world. So when we really do tease this out in terms of HIV prevalence, one sees the feminization of the epidemic and these enormous numbers in countries, particularly towards the southern tip of Africa. There are many reasons for this, but some of them biological, some of them behavioral, some of them social. But it again translates into young women in southern Africa being 3 to 6 times more likely to have HIV than their male counterparts of similar age. And this is data from the Household Survey in South Africa, again, bringing home the step up that we see from just under 16, 17 years of age of an increasing amount of HIV infection, particularly amongst young women, resulting in these very high prevalence rates, and really as a result of very high incidence rates, their male counterparts following some years later. This is data from Croatia's sites, and also just to make the point, we see this in other parts of South Africa as well, data from Cape Town of prevalence in the case of KZN amongst antenatal care workers, and you see this step up as age goes from 16 to 20, and similarly in Cape Town amongst a general female population. Anyone can work out that this amounts to a very high incidence. And in fact, in KZN, that incidence between the ages of 16 and 35, 9%. And in Cape Town, a study we did some years ago, between 16 and 20, an incidence of 8%. Debbie Burt, I thought, really illustrated this very beautifully today, that on the back of this current situation, we are aware that we are coming into what has become known as Africa's youth bulge. And this is kind of imminent and about to happen, where we are really going to see an explosion of people in their youth, their adolescence, in Africa in particular, compared to the rest of the world. And it really is now that we need to try and contain this incidence, because otherwise we are really going to be inundated with young people living with HIV. And just to again make the point, the youth bulge is in that age group of sort of 10 to 19. Turning to key populations, we know that people who live with, who use drugs are also young, and 1 in 10 new infections occur in IDUs around the world. That globally, female sex workers are 13.5 times more likely to be HIV infected. MSM are 19 times more likely to be HIV positive. And there are extraordinary high rates of HIV amongst prisoners, detainees, the homeless, misplaced, etc. We know that the youth amongst those key populations are particularly at risk. So quickly moving through this, IVDU occurs in youth, and YDU are more likely to be HIV infected. So globally, more than 70% of IVDU are under the age of 25. In Brazil, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, 30 to 80% of YDU are already HIV infected. So, you know, again, these populations very vulnerable. Sex workers tend to start their careers young. Here you see an age around anything from 16 to 24, and again are at great risk for HIV infection. MSM are often young, and young MSM are more often at risk. So in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, 14 to 20% of HIV is occurring in the 15 to 24-year-olds. And here in the Northern America, 93% new HIV in 13 to 19-year-olds. Of course, there are other youth at risk, some of them connected to these key populations. So 50 to 90% of young people who inject drugs will be incarcerated. Young sex workers are more likely to inject. There are high rates of detection, of course, amongst young sex workers, more likely to have STIs, less knowledge, have difficulty to access services. And of course, these other key populations also at risk for HIV. We know that adolescence is a developmental transition. Biological and behavioral vulnerabilities occur within that. And we know as a result there's greater risk-taking, there's this concept of present bias, poor knowledge and application of that knowledge, lack of abstract thought, disregard for rules and establishment, poor health-seeking behaviors. They face prejudicial and inadequate health services and often complain about a lack of privacy. So the conclusions I would draw from this is that we really are failing adolescents globally. There are a number of reports coming out, and I haven't quoted them all, but really drawing our attention to this often forgotten population. that young key populations globally and young women and adolescent girls in sub-Saharan Africa are extraordinarily at risk for HIV. HIV treatment outcomes for youth are poor, leading to unacceptable mortality. And our options for HIV prevention are really limited at this time. There is this unprecedented youth bulge that is occurring in Africa and exacerbating our urgency to get solutions as soon as possible. So again, I would contest tailored, adolescent-friendly, acceptable and feasible prevention packages for YKPs and young women and adolescent girls are urgently needed. Youth are at the center of the epidemic in all scenarios and groups. They can't afford to wait, and certainly neither can we. With thanks.
So thanks so much, Linda Gallen. She's really laid out the charge of why we're here today, with the center of the epidemic being in adolescence, the unmet need in adolescence. We really have a call to action to not do business the same way. We need to find mechanisms by which we can identify prevention modalities that are really going to work for these young people. With that, I'd like to call on Sybil Hozick, who's done, I think, something quite innovative in her attempts to ensure that PrEP can be rolled out to adolescents in the United States. Sybil is a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry at the John Stroger Hospital of Cook County in Chicago, and she's really been doing some innovative work in the area of PrEP and is going to really share with us the story of how they were able to expand the studies for oral PrEP in adolescents without parental consent.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you, Connie, for having us here. And just to say, it wasn't my extraordinary effort. It was the effort of the Adolescent Trials Network. And actually, in the audience, we have not only my co-chair, Craig Wilson, who's the ATNPI, but the IND holder of this study, which is Bill Capogiannis from NICHD, as well as several Adolescent Trials Network site PIs who may want to, in the discussion, share their experience with this challenging approach to a prevention study. So we're going to talk about ATN-113. Which is the sister study to ATN-110 being prepared or being discussed tomorrow, which is an open-label demonstration trial and safety study for young men who have sex with men. These were twin studies separated at birth for 18 to 22-year-olds and 15 to 17-year-olds, and part of the reason for that split was the anticipation of some potential regulatory and IRB holdups with the 15 to 17-year-olds. So our rationale for ATN-113, we started talking about this study actually right after the IPREX results came out. And at that time, there were no existing PrEP trials in adolescent minors. And to date, that's still true in terms of the data that's existing. Linda Gale also has a study in the field looking at young men and women on PrEP, but we don't have data from either her study or our study to date. We did, though, however, have reassuring adult PrEP safety data along with years of pediatric treatment safety data for Truvada, tenofovir emtricitabine. And we had efficacy data from several of the adult PrEP trials that really supported proof of concept as well as the prospect for direct benefit to the young person. So even though we had this data, we still needed, and the FDA had actually asked us for additional data on safety as well as effectiveness of PrEP for those that are at highest risk. And in the United States, that's young people and particularly racial and ethnic minority youth. So one of the questions we asked ourselves was, why should we let youth consent for themselves? And why is that the approach that we wanted to take for this trial? And the first consideration really was the safety of the participants, that the disclosure of sexual orientation to parents was not practicable. It could lead to physical harm, emotional harm. It could lead to housing instability. And it was something that we did not want our youth to have to go through in order to be part of a trial. We thought also that requiring parental consent would actually exclude potentially the highest risk youth, youth who did not have social support, who did not have understanding families, who would not be able to get a parent to allow them to participate in this study. Furthermore, because this was a licensing trial, an IND study, the FDA regulations do not allow for waivers of parental consent. So our choices were either to have parental permission for the study or to allow the youth to consent for themselves. And we realize after many conversations that there are actually local regulations in many of the jurisdictions that we do our work in that allow mature minors to seek medical care as well as prevention services for contraception or HIV or STIs. So we went through several layers of consultation around this, and the ATN very seriously considers, you know, the community regard for the studies that we do, and we have a long-standing infrastructure, community infrastructure that we take these studies to, and part of that infrastructure and impact in the community is having an ethics advisory panel. And so we did bring together the ethics advisory panel of the ATN to start to discuss this study with them. And these are some of the conclusions that they came to during their consultation around this study. First, citing CFR 46.402, that children are people who have not attained the legal age for consent to treatment. And so per local laws, participants in 113 may have actually reached the age of maturity because they were allowed in those local jurisdictions to consent to, say, contraception or HIV testing or care under many of the local laws. In addition, there was concern, well, would youth be able to comprehend and accurately consent to these procedures? But the ethics advisory panel felt that the strength of the prior PrEP data was so clear and the likelihood of benefit with very little risk was so clear that the capacity for adolescents to be able to consent for these trials did not require an advanced assessment of competency. And so actually, to our surprise, the ethics advisory panel unanimously supported that youth should be consenting for themselves for this protocol, although they did say to us that the involvement of parents should be optional. And of course, for any young person who wanted to bring a parent in, who had a supportive parent or a supportive caregiver and that wanted to help them with the consent process and involvement in the study, we encouraged that. We also had a pre-IND review with the FDA, and I'm not going to read through this in this show you data from their document, but basically they concurred with what the ethics advisory panel said, as well as our, you know, approach to have youth give informed consent. I think really important, though, was this last piece here, where they took it a step further in saying that in addition, any site that is not going to allow an adolescent to consent for themselves should not participate in this study. So really not allowing, you know, the sites to determine which way they should go, but that this was the appropriate way to go, that these adolescents should be able to consent for themselves, and that sites that could not do that should not be allowed to enroll adolescents in this study. And then finally, we consulted with OHRP, the Office of Human Research Protections, through NIH, showed them our evaluation from the advisory panel as well as our consultation with the FDA, and they agreed also that this was consistent in their thoughts with the CFR, and that if under local laws youth could consent for themselves, then that should be appropriate for this research study as well. So in order to implement ATN 113, we brought together all of these consultation materials and provided them to the sites. And in addition to that, encouraged the site investigators to begin conversations with their IRBs ahead of time. We had these documents. We've had these discussions. Go and have side conversations, informal meetings with your IRB before the actual protocol comes out so that they're prepared for this and they can start to think about these really complicated issues ahead of time. And then, of course, any of the site IRBs could have requested these materials as well. We also launched a community education initiative through our ATN coalitions and through our existing infrastructure called Connect to Protect. We began to do pretty broad spread community education around these protocols coming forward. And as part of the 113 study, we had a sub-aim, which was to gather this correspondence from the IRBs and from the site investigators, really so that we could document what this process was like and how the IRBs responded. And as you see, only half of the sites that participated in the 18 to 22-year-old study were approved to participate in 113. So we lost about half of our sites, largely because of this issue. Just this month, some of the data is coming out from that ATN sub-study led by Amy Lewis-Gilbert, as well as several of us on the protocol team. And I'm just going to give you an example from that article of two IRBs, one that approved the study and one that didn't, but really citing very similar local law. So this site that approved the The study said that, yes, in this state, minors can consent to HIV testing and treatment without parental consent. Therefore, the IRB felt that this met the requirements for the study, and these potential participants who were seeking participation for prevention therapy could enroll. Conversely, this site that did not approve said that, yes, our site local laws provide minors the ability to consent for the treatment of STDs, including HIV, but don't specifically provide minors the ability to consent to any treatment for the prevention of STDs, including HIV, and therefore the study was not approved at that site. So the absence of prevention language is often interpreted in very varied ways, depending on the site IRBs, as well as the institutional attorneys and risk management team. Just to say, you know, anecdotally, as we're moving through 113, we still have about 4 or 5 months of follow-up to go. But we did at the beginning have several participants that really asked for extended time going through the informed consent process and wanted to be able to speak to their parents, ask them questions. We've had parents call us to discuss the study, and we've had parents come in for study visits. We have also had many participants tell us that they would never have been able to participate in this study if they had to get parental consent. So the option of having parents was really important for some people, but not requiring it really helped us to be able to get the highest risk youth into the study. At baseline, we have had 2 participants withdraw consent due to fear that their parents would discover their involvement in this study, as well as a participant that prematurely discontinued at week 12, saying that his mother's awareness of the study was just creating too much of a difficult situation at home, as well as with his friends and partner. So in conclusion, we, you know, concur that adolescents at risk need to have access to new prevention technologies, that when consulted, you know, pretty consistently across ethical and regulatory experts, they agreed that minors should not necessarily be considered children if they are able to consent to treatment and prevention services. And if they are not children, then they are allowed to consent to themselves for treatment and don't need those additional protections that are meant for children in the Code of Federal Regulations. I think critically important is that IRBs and institutional risk management teams need to be educated about minor provisions as they relate to the local law, and conversations about these things ahead of time before there's a protocol in front of them is really critical. That when supportive parents and guardians are available and they can be included at the youth's discretion, it's the mandate to have them involved that can be a barrier, and that clearly community consultation is an important part of successful implementation of adolescent protocols. So I want to thank my protocol team and those that are in the audience with me, and happy to have this discussion.
So thank you very much, Sybil. That was really informative. And for those who have joined late, we're about one-third of the way through the presentations, and we're trying to keep things on track and saving comments for the end. We really want to have a lively and hopefully productive discussion, so write down comments as you're having them. Our next speaker is also known to many of us in the room, Dr. Zita Rosenberg, who is the founding chief executive officer of the International Partnership for Microbicides, and really a long-term scientific and more than even scientific, she's put her heart and soul into development of prevention technologies for women. The one she will tell us about today is the dapivirine ring, and she'll tell us about the regulatory pathway.
Maybe. Is it not happy? Maybe I will. He's coming up.
Yeah, it's thinking about it.
Yeah, it's thinking. It's hung up. That's okay. It's giving me a vaginal ring right there. Well, actually, I will start because I realize my presentation just kind of jumps into
a whole lot of details, and I realize that there may be many of you who actually don't know what the ring is. And the vaginal, dapivirine vaginal ring we're talking about today is a ring, a silicone ring that contains an antiretroviral drug, which is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, dapivirine. And one thing that's important, about dapivirine is that it is what's called a new chemical entity. So it's a drug that has not been proven to be efficacious in humans as an antiretroviral drug. And it was licensed to IPM by Janssen in 2004. And it has had a lot of experience in treatment trials. And then we got it to go into prevention trials as a microbicide. And we formulated it as gels, films, and rings. And the ring is what has been carried forward into the phase 3 efficacy program with both the Microbicide Trials Network in the trial Aspire and with IPM with the ring study. And so the importance of it being a new chemical entity may come into play when we think about testing the dapivirine ring in adolescents and especially in African settings. So let me just move maybe. Oh, there we go. Okay. So there is, because we're developing this ring to be a marketed product, IPM is the license holder and the regulatory sponsor of this product. We also developed the ring. We figured out its formulation and manufacturing, et cetera. And because it is in a licensure program, we, like everyone here who has developed drugs, has gone through consultations with the FDA and the European Medicines Agency, and actually EMA will be probably our primary regulatory agency. And there's a whole lot of background work that is needed. From a clinical perspective, the licensure program is two large phase 3 trials. One of them, as I mentioned, is IPM027, which has approximately nearly 2,000 participants. It's ongoing. The Aspire study, which had more than 2,600 participants, which is now in its data analysis stage. So by the end of this year, we will probably know all of the efficacy data for this ring, as well as the safety, which is critically important, as you can imagine, for a prevention indication. But there's a lot of additional studies that the regulatory agencies need to see as part of a licensure program. Some of them relate to drug-drug interactions. If you use a vaginal ring containing dapivirine with a drug for either treatment of fungal infections or bacterial infections, will both drugs still work? Or do they interact and cancel each other out? Looking at how long the ring could be effective, how long dapivirine comes out of the ring once it's in there. The testing is for monthly use, but we know that there's enough dapivirine in that ring that it will be very forgiving for longer than a month. And in fact, our extended PK could suggest it could be 2 or 3 months in duration. But given that the clinical trials are being done with 1 monthly use of the ring, that will be in the label. So a lot of what we're going to talk about too is what it says on the label. You can only say on the label what you've actually proven clinically. And so you can't kind of be making claims that you haven't shown in your phase 3 program. We've also shown that the ring is safe to use with the male condom and even with the female condom, which we weren't certain that was going to be the case because you would have 2 vaginal rings because it was tested with the female condom that had an inner ring. But both rings could stay in place and there was no additional slippage or breakage of either male or female condoms when used with the ring. So again, very important for a label. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't get approved, it just would say, do not use this with a female condom. So the label language is critical for approval. And of course, the regulators want to know, is the ring safe in women who are over 45 and in adolescents? The clinical trial participants for the phase 3 trials are between the ages of 18 and 45. So we need to know whether or not, outside of that population, whether that ring would be safe. And so the Microbicide Trials Network has been doing this study in menopausal women, and then the Adolescent Trials Network and the Microbicide Trials Network has been doing this study in adolescents. and menses and tampon use. When, if a woman is menstruating and she uses a tampon, is it possible for the tampon to soak up dapivirine? Would it still be effective? So there are a number, and that study is ongoing. So a lot of these different studies, and when all of this package is submitted to the regulators, they could come back and say, you know what, we thought of some others. So there's always that possibility of studies that you have to do during the review period. So we always kind of wait to see what happens there. Is it not moving? This thing doesn't like me. There we go. So where are we right now with dapivirine ring? We are in the both phase three studies and doing the supporting safety and PK studies. And as I mentioned, we've had a number of regulatory consultations over the years. The phase three program started in 2012, so we've had a lot of time to talk to the regulators. And in fact, they've had joint consultations, the FDA and the EMA and African national regulatory agencies. So we've had a lot of people together in one room, all listening to each other, all having somewhat separate advice and consultation, which you kind of have to merge together. We will, if we find efficacy in both of these trials, we will be doing open label extension studies in 2016, which means that all women who have been involved in the phase three program will be offered access to the ring in another clinical trial because the product will not yet have been approved. And so this will give early access to women to an effective product should these trials work. And then the dossier submission will be towards the end of 2016 to the European Medicine Agency under an Article 58, which allows for the review of the dossier for safety and efficacy and a scientific opinion that will then be used by WHO for pre-qualification and the African, and then submission to the African NRAs. It is a long process, and it can take several years. We will also be submitting to the U.S. FDA, likely in 2017, because of some requirements that they have in addition to EMA, and we'll be doing simultaneous dossier submission to the South African Medicines Control Council. So hopefully all of that will allow for product approval and hopefully access by 2018, somewhere, somehow. So this is all to tee up the next presentation, which is about the study of dapivirine ring in adolescents. And the FDA has specifically required and asked for safety data in this population because they realize that when something is on the market in the U.S., it is very difficult to start to distinguish between someone who is 17 and someone who is 18. And there is there's a lot of off-label use, and they want to make sure that the product is safe in that age population because they also realize that these younger adolescents are at high risk of infection. And the FDA has to think about the U.S. population. We, of course, here are thinking about dapivirine ring in the African context, so we also want this information. It's critical. And whether or not a South African Medicines Control Council will approve it for adolescents, they will follow a lot of the guidance of many other regulatory agencies. I think it will be very helpful for many African national regulatory authorities to see safety data in the U.S., as well as perhaps expect safety data in other countries. And so we are prepared for doing safety studies in different African countries. So there is a trial. It's the MTN-023 study that you'll hear in much more detail next, IPM-030, which is a phase 2A, two-arm, placebo-controlled, double-blinded, randomized in 3-to-1 ratio with 96 expected participants to look at the safety of dapivirine ring and evaluate its acceptability, adherence, and pharmacokinetics in adolescent females. It is going on right now, and you'll hear about some of the challenges with that trial. and it's expected to complete next year. We feel very strongly that conducting that study now will save a lot of time for future regulatory submission. You don't want to go through the submission of a dossier and then have a review of 6 to 9 months and then have the FDA come back and say, you really should be testing this here, there. So you want to do it in parallel and you want to do it before submission. And again, as I mentioned, there is likely to be at least one, if not multiple, African adolescent safety studies because many different countries may want to see it in their own populations. So with that, I will stop and then we will hear much more about this trial. So thank you.
Thanks, Zita. So what we've heard is there's an urgent need for products for adolescents. We've heard how the Adolescent Trials Network really thought about how to take the licensed product and get the labeling studies done so it could be used by adolescents in the United States. And you've heard about this new product, the dapivirine ring, which is moving forward for HIV prevention in women. And you've heard that the regulators have requested safety data in adolescents. And so we thought it would be great to have Catherine Bungie, who's going to be our next speaker, who's the protocol co-chair for the MTN-023 study, talk about some of what it's taken to actually provide the data that's been requested by the Food and Drug Administration to ensure that there can be some safety data to support a labeling claim. Katie?
Thank you. Great. Well, as the importance of obtaining safety data, the dapivirine vaginal ring has always, in adolescents has already been addressed, I'm just going to dive into the study and really spend some time talking about some of the enrollment challenges that we've had. So MTN-023, or IPM-030, which has been commonly referred to as Project iMatter now, is a phase 2A safety study of the vaginal ring containing dapivirine in adolescent females. It truly is a collaborative effort between the Adolescent Trial Network and the Microbicide Trial Network. When the study first started, there were actually 4 sites only. 3 were ATN sites, Denver, Bronx, and Boston, and 1 MTN site, Birmingham, but as I'll explain with the enrollment challenges, we've actually brought on 2 additional sites, 1 ATN site, St. Jude, Memphis site, and then 1 MTN site, the Pittsburgh site. The target study population for the 023 trial, Project iMatter, is 96 HIV negative 15 to 17 year old teens in good health. And in order to be eligible, the teens have to be on an effective method of contraception. They need to have had 1 episode, at least, of penile vaginal intercourse in their life, and they need parental consent. So it's a tall order. Once enrolled, the participants use the ring monthly, and they undergo safety assessments, first at 2 weeks of study product use, and then monthly thereafter. And these study assessments include pelvic exams and blood draws, and the participants are followed for 6 months. So this is the real story of the Project iMatter. It's been very challenging to enroll participants. Enrollment began in June of 2014, and as this graph illustrates, it's been a difficult process. So thankfully, in the last several months, from March 2015 until today, there's been sort of an uptick in enrollment, but on the whole, it's really been a difficult and trying process. So as of Friday, there were 46 teens enrolled, and I know of at least one that was enrolled today, so we're now at 47 at least. I am going to delve into some key enrollment challenges, and there really have been a lot, but I'm going to focus on the top 4 in my mind. 1 is the varying determinations of risk by the local IRBs. The 2nd, access denied to potential referral sources. The 3rd is needing to think outside the box with respect to advertising and trying to recruit teens. And then lastly, and most importantly, this hurdle of obtaining parental consent for this trial. So 1, varying determinations of risk. I think Sybil kind of was sort of talking in parallel a little bit here because, despite the same protocol being submitted to each local IRB, the IRBs interpreted the risk-benefit ratios pretty differently and as a result came up with different risk determinations for the same protocol. So with the 4 initial sites, 3 sites actually deemed the study to be greater than minimal risk with the prospect of direct benefit, and specifically citing STD and contraceptive counseling, which are part of the study procedures, as the prospect of direct benefit for these teens. But one site deemed that the study was greater than minimal risk, but had no prospect of direct benefit, but it was likely to yield generalizable knowledge about the subject's disorder or condition. That disorder or condition presumably being adolescence, which we've all suffered through. But in any event, several months into the study, it became clear that this, the penile vaginal intercourse in the teens, it's struggling with how to introduce the study to their parents without necessarily addressing this issue, was front and center. And so the protocol team contemplated removing the very specific criterion of penile vaginal intercourse and replacing it with more general vaginal practice like oral sex or tampon use. And so we anticipated that the IRBs, that this might likely change the risk-benefit profile for the IRBs, and so we encouraged all the sites. At this point, we had Memphis and Pittsburgh on board too, each site to discuss the potential changes with the IRBs. And it was really that process that made it strikingly clear to us and the protocol team and the site staff that the IRBs really did vary significantly in how they interpreted risk-benefit and how they applied the ICH guidelines to the proposed changes. To the extent that, for example, one site IRB thought that if you remove the penile-vaginal intercourse as a criterion, you now have young women who will not have benefit from STD and contraceptive counseling because they have not actually had penile-vaginal intercourse. Other IRBs expressed concern that if you start doing pelvic exams and requiring contraceptive use in girls who have not had penile vaginal intercourse, that might bump the risk profile. So all in all, it was really instructive and confusing. But at the end of the day, we decided to stick with the original inclusion criteria because we didn't really want to go with the most conservative IRB's interpretation. So we did not change the inclusion criterion. There we go. A second issue was access denied. So different sites met with different obstacles, but some examples of access to potential referral sources included departments of health at one site, general health fairs, most public schools and some private schools, youth after school programs, and friends of current participants. And most often when explaining why study site staff couldn't post flyers or discuss the study at these venues, the most commonly cited reason was sort of a general, the study just isn't a good fit, with the subtext that there's some concern that talking about a reproductive health study might be construed as promoting sex in those venues. And of course, also some stakeholders did express concern over protecting teen confidentiality. The third issue was needing to think outside the box. And so our study site staff found quickly that the recruitment materials that had worked in the past weren't necessarily working for Project iMatters. So the backbone of traditional advertising with emails, posters, and flyers were meeting with limited success. In addition, Facebook and Instagram were also sort of not panning out as much as it had for ATN 113 and some other ATN sites. In the end, and what's happening now that seems to be most successful is relying on referrals from a trusted source. So specifically, we have met with some good success with staff members of adolescent and gynecology clinics talking about the study to their patients and then introducing the potential participant to a site staff member who can have a one-on-one conversation following the introduction and actually discuss with the teen in person any concerns they might have about the study or the product itself. So for example, we don't have a ring to show you, but often one of the first questions is that gonna fit? Because it looks intimidating, but it's actually very flexible. The other advantage to this face-to-face discussion with the teens before engaging the parent is that it gives the opportunity for the site staff to review exactly what is in the consent form so that it's clear to the teen what information is disclosed to the parent about the study. We have still, though, relied on some old-fashioned advertising. So we do have bus ads and condoms, postcards, and T-shirts that have captured a handful of participants here and there. But I think for sure the referral from the trusted source seems to be really where the key recruitment efforts lie. And then lastly, but certainly not least, is this difficulty with obtaining parental consent. Teens are really reluctant to discuss reproductive health studies with their parents. And so I guess it's not surprising, but what needs to be emphasized is that actually most sites don't explicitly state the eligibility criterion of a history of penile vaginal intercourse in the consent form. I think actually only Pittsburgh site does explicitly state that. So the discussion with the teen before introducing the parent to the consent form has been really helpful to explain exactly what information is disclosed to the parent in the consent form about the study. But even though the teens do get some reassurances about what is and what is not in the consent form, I think just the potential for disclosure of sexual activity is enough to turn teens away from the study. For those teens that do get to a point where they're willing to engage their parents in a discussion, this is the least of our worries, honestly, but it should be noted that obtaining parental consent does require flexibility. So parents' schedules are different than teen schedules, and a lot of sites have had to institute morning and evening hours in order to accommodate the parents. In addition, some sites have even gone off site to the parents' home to try to obtain consent. Anything to make it easy and doable for the parent. So in thinking about the challenges that we faced in Project iMatter and then looking ahead, I guess I wonder if the field of adolescent reproductive research wouldn't really benefit from some consensus building around risk determination and probably even more importantly, a really frank discussion with stakeholders and trying to engage them about the value of reproductive research in adolescent populations. All right, I'd like to thank the participants and their guardians, and then, of course, IPM and the two networks that are running this trial, MTN and ATN. Thanks.
Thank you, Katie. That was sobering. And anyone who lives in Boston, Denver, Pittsburgh, I forget the other two several cities, but should be thinking about how to help with recruitment. But now we're going to shift to South Africa, where really, as Linda Gale's slides really emphasize, the burden of the epidemic is in Southern Africa. And we're very lucky to have Qureisha Abdul Karim here to talk about regulatory and community constructs in rural South Africa, and really with a focus on the way forward for adolescents.
Thanks, Connie. So I'm pleased I have technical support here because I'm a real technophobe. And while I let the slides come up, I just wanted to thank the organizers for the opportunity to be part of this really excellent panel. And I think as I've worked with adolescents, the one thing I've learned with all the other partners as well is nothing is cast in granite. And I think one of the key issues in terms of working with adolescents, it really emanates also from working with women. And so in working with women, I hope my time is not going well. I mean, the slide is going. There's this book called, Men Are From Mars and Women From Venus. And I think as you start talking to people about adolescence, you kind of think this look comes over them like adolescents are from Neptune or something like that. And this is taking a little bit longer. And I'm not a stand-up comedian, so... So I was talking about the fluidity in terms of the context within which we work. And Linda Gale very nicely put up some of the slides which talk to the public health imperative of intervening with this group, and whether we're talking about young MSM, whether we're talking about injecting drug users, or whether we're talking about adolescent women in southern and eastern Africa. And I have the one slide that I wanted to remind you, and I just wanted to flash it again, because between Linda Gale's presentation and all the other fantastic presentations in between, I just wanted to remind you of what I think about when I wake up in the morning. What is that picture I want to change? So a lot of what I do is in a rural community, which is about an hour and a half west of Durban. And in the past decade of working in this community, I have been doing surveillance, monitoring of the evolving epidemic, surveillance in antenatal clinics, and that's some of the data that Linda Gale put up, which is where you see 30% of young women coming to antenatal clinics are under the age of 18. And by age 16, 1 in 10 is infected with HIV. By age 19, it's 1 in 3. By age 24, it's 1 in 2. So you kind of walk in and you think, here's the clinic of pregnant women, every other woman. And then, so part of putting that data up is to tell you, not only do we have this HIV acquisition from a very young age, but we also, as we think about prevention, we shouldn't forget about the care needs of adolescents. And if the care needs for pediatric populations and aging pediatric populations have been ignored, I think we don't pay enough attention to that. So as we do prevention efforts, particularly in these high incidence countries, we need to pay attention to treatment needs as well and ancillary care needs, because these are young women who are having sex. So you have to worry about HIV, you have to worry about other STIs, and you also have to worry about fertility control. So you can't separate out your HIV prevention needs from broader sexual reproductive health needs. The other slide I wanted to put up was, well, we see this in the antenatal clinic. So imagine with me, at some point the slides will go up. We do work in high schools. You get to high schools and you see a picture very similar, where in young men, all the way up to age 22, HIV infection is less than 2%. But young women, even in high school, second year of high school, you're starting to see a steady increase in HIV infection. So you think about those two pictures, and when do you actually start? And so everybody knows when you're working with adolescents, it's a very sensitive topic. Everybody is an expert on it, and everybody has 30 opinions, and you get weighed down. And I also have three young kids, and so I also learn as they're growing up what some of the challenges are. And it's been useful to see some of the challenges I face as a parent to young kids, how that plays out in broader communities. So I can identify with parents and some of the parental concerns. So the first thing I do is present this data. And whatever you feel, whatever you think, that data tells you as it is. That's what is there. And there's nothing more shocking for any stakeholder, whether it's a community advisory board or whoever, when they see that data. This is the reality. It's not something like happening somewhere else. This is in our community. This is the magnitude of the problem. This is the severity of the problem. And immediately the response is, what can we do to change this picture? So that group of people who think this picture needs to be changed has been steadily growing. And that's when I've learned about fluidity. And people can come in kicking and screaming about why you shouldn't do this and what whoever says and everybody else doesn't say. So you take the same thing to the IRBs. And the IRBs immediately get, here's not only a public health imperative, there's also an ethical imperative. You take that to the regulatory bodies, and the regulatory bodies have to deal with these are the facts. So there's another piece around human rights that says the way you treat the most marginalized in your society is really talks to a lot about where does the society stand? And if we have to take the most marginalized, and we look at where new infections are taking place globally or locally, it's all in marginalized populations. So whether we're talking sex workers, whether we're talking injecting drug users, whether we're talking about MSM populations, etc., there's some, although we have one of the most liberal constitutions in terms of sexual orientation and rights, at a social level, there's a lot of stigma and discrimination. In countries around us, there are laws that say same-sex relationships are illegal, and there are laws in my country that says adolescents having sex is illegal. So, you know, we can say and be bogged down with what is legal and not illegal. And I kind of think I'm a public health practitioner. I'm an epidemiologist. I got to deal with my public health challenges. I really don't care about the law. And so a lot about, so here's the violations of the rights. And if we stand for human rights and all human respect for human rights, then we find ways to actually deal with those challenges. You know, we have a lot of studies that have been done in sex workers, and there are very few countries in the world where sex work is legal. So, you know, we've been talking for 3 decades about decriminalization of sex work. And so I'm raising these issues because even when we're talking about young MSM, in those countries where it's illegal, you can't make that the barrier. You've got to look at where are the infections occurring, how do we deal with it. So one of the things that I've learned is that because of all these sensitivities, you've got to start these conversations very early on. And you've got to map out who are the key stakeholders that you've got to talk about, talk to and talk about. So it's your regulatory bodies, which is both whoever oversees medicines control in the country and also your IRBs. And there are lots of IRBs, and each one has different opinions. And so basically, you just got to work and, you know, just chip away, until they just get so exhausted, they have to give in. And Tommy, I've been chipping away for nearly 3 decades at this. And, you know, we're starting to get some way. It's young people are in people's radar screen, and some people are now starting to talk about what can we do. And there's a lot of experience in working with young people. So the community engagement is really important. And one of the things that we've done in our work with adolescents is expand our community advisory board. So there's good participatory practices documents that give you a whole list of things that you should be doing, and you should have a community advisory board. And if you're working with adolescents and you don't have adolescent representation in your community advisory board, you should put that in. If you're working in schools, for example, they are school governing boards. And, I can race through this. So I think I've pretty much covered some of these things. And I should just say this picture is here despite the fact that we provide antiretroviral treatment as medical male circumcision became available, is being provided. We are doing studies of microbicides in women over 18. But unless we start to work actively with this group way before we have the proven technologies, we're going to be losing more ground. And some people disagree that there are age-sex differences. I just want to tell you, this is the data I see in the communities that I work with. And you can see by age 19, these are the school kid data. And I wanted to highlight here, it depends on where you start to enroll people. Clearly, where you are still doing proof of concept studies, the issues are a little bit more complex and complicated. But, you know, everything we do is complex and complicated, and we've got to figure out ways to deal with these issues. So I wanted to highlight here that meaningful engagement and inclusion of adolescents in research and programmatic initiatives is not just crucial for societal inclusivity and social cohesion, but really an ethical imperative. And so we've done that. I have to catch up with these slides. And sometimes I'm wondering, should I even bother with these slides? But let me keep going. I wanted to show you in this particular community what family structure looks like. So if you, you know, there's all this thing about when you're working with adolescents, you need parental consent, and you need consent, and you need assent. Well, this is what family structure looks like. So only 17% of the boys, well, let's say about 18% of the kids have both parents. Most of these kids are coming from female-headed households where only the mother is present. We have about 3% child-headed households, and about 17 or 18% of father, and there's something like a third of the kids are coming from households where none of these structures actually apply. So they could be under foster care or grandparent looked after or something like that. So when we went to the IRB, we went to them mainly to ask them if it was okay what the Community Advisory Board had done when we had initiated this particular study was establish a school research support group as a subcommittee. And the school research support group was supposed to be present in the schools we're going to be, provide some oversight, and tell us if there was any issues that they were finding in the schools, etc. And then as we learned about this large number of kids who were in need of proxy consent, that these individuals would stand in as the parent or the guardian, even though formal guardianship doesn't exist in these rural communities. So when we presented that to the IRB said, well, given that about two-thirds of the kids are going to need this alternate form of consenting, why don't you do a cognitive assessment? And for all kids who have the cognitive ability for first-person consent, do that. So our IRB actually gave us more than what we wanted. And so it kind of made us think about maybe we shouldn't set the bar too low, but really push it high. So just to give you some idea, about 70% of the kids were able to get consent and assent. About 25% of where we had one or other parent refused for the kids to participate. And we also had less than 2% of the kids didn't have cognitive ability and really should be in special schools. And clearly we didn't include those individuals. But what was important here was how the community did not want to discriminate further against already vulnerable kids and had come up with a solution. The other thing I was thinking about as Katie was talking about enrollment and so on is another facet of the involvement of youth in their own solutions. And so we found there was a need for ancillary care, and there were a whole lot of issues in terms of them accessing that at the primary healthcare clinics. So we decided to go out with these mobile units around the schools or in the schools where the school governing bodies were in agreement to these services being provided. And we didn't have a huge uptake of these SRH services. But as soon as we started to train the early and instant adopters of these services to be peer ambassadors, so they go out, provide information, be there to support, bring the other learners who were dithering about should we or shouldn't we come. And then as we started to initiate them on fertility control methods, support adherence and so on, just that intervention, which was started around May 2014, within weeks, we saw the numbers go up substantially. So peer ambassadors are really important and make a big difference. So just to conclude, inclusion of adolescents in prevention trials are both a public health and ethical imperative. The engagement with community, with regulatory bodies, and the development of flexible and adaptive procedures are critical to facilitate the inclusion of adolescents in HIV prevention trials. And the inclusion of adolescents in the development and implementation of interventions is absolutely critical. So we can't go to them with the fait accompli. And if we're saying they're so important and we really want to change what their risk profile looks like and we want to intervene, I think at this point in time, we have quite a wide array of self-initiated technologies, all the way from tablets, imminently a ring, injectables, etc. They really should have the opportunity to choose what it is they want to use. And then I think we'll overcome some of the accrual challenges we face, some of the adherence challenges, etc. So a whole lot of people to thank, and I'll leave that. And thank you very much.
We have to acknowledge that Karisha did an amazing job of remembering what was in her slides. So we'll hope that the final presentation does not suffer similar technical issues. But we're delighted to end the formal remarks for this session with Dr. Paul Ndebele, who's an ethicist and currently director of the Medical Research Council of Zimbabwe. And he served in that role since 2013. And I think Paul brings to us a really an interesting perspective, both is from his time serving as a bioethicist at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, as well as in his current role as head of the Medical Research Council. Paul?
Thank you very much. Good evening. You might have observed one thing about all the presenters in this session. All of them are women or mothers, and here I am. I am the only one, the father, to talk about issues of adolescence. And as we think about this issue, early in the morning I just got some message from home. So my wife just sent a message to say our son is about to be suspended from school. He's 16. And the issue was he was kissing some 14-year-old, and someone was recording, and then they took the recording to the principal of the school. So my wife is a trained counselor, but here I was now trying to advise her to say, no, look, these things happen. No, I was now talking about sexuality, so I was actually reminded of this particular presentation. So these are some of the issues I'm going to touch on tonight. The presentations that have been given already have illustrated to us some serious challenges facing our adolescents, the issues of pregnancies among our adolescents, and in some countries these might actually be as high as 143 per thousand. And with these pregnancies, there are also issues of abortion being demanded by teenagers. And in countries where abortions are illegal, we then find our adolescents going for backstreet abortions with severe consequences. From the statistics that were also provided, we now realize that a lot, especially of the girls, are actually getting infected because there are some older men who are actually engaging with them. So we talk of sugar daddies and sugar mummies. In some countries, there have been debates about distribution of condoms in schools. And I know in some schools, they're already distributing condoms. So it is actually a fact that a growing number of adolescents are engaging in unprotected sex. So these are realities out there, and yet these realities are not yet translated into the area of HIV prevention research. In our various countries, we've got lots of regulations that are to do with reproductive health, and these also touch on consent. For example, in a lot of countries, the age of consent to medical treatment is 14, realizing that someone at that age can actually make a decision to their own advantage. And in Zimbabwe, for example, a minor may access family planning services at age 10. So if they're accessing these at age 10, what you are simply saying is they're actually engaging in sexual activities. And in a lot of countries, the age of consent for sex ranges from 14 to 16. In a lot of countries, adolescents can test for HIV at ages 14 or 16. And in South Africa, for example, a girl as young as 12 can request for an abortion without parental consent. The girl is encouraged to go and talk to their parents if it is possible, but they can still go ahead with the abortion without consent of their parents. If you look at all these legislations and policies, they actually take into cognizance the fact that adolescents are engaging in unprotected sexual activities. So all these, they actually recognize the issue of adolescence. And yet, that same adolescent can only consent to participate in research at the legal age of majority, which is 18 years in a lot of countries, or 21 in some countries. So if you look at the child care laws that we have and also our constitutions, they do not recognize that phase of adolescence. But here we are looking at all these other legislations and policies that recognize adolescence. So this actually creates some of the problems that were discussed during the previous presentations. If we are looking at the realities around parental consent, this actually comes from the historical protection of minors. There is this idea that minors are vulnerable in terms of their physiology, also in terms of thought processes, and hence parental consent is then recognized worldwide as an important protection for children or for adolescents. But if you consider what was discussed earlier on, the feasibility of obtaining parental permission may be a problem, especially if you are looking at HIV prevention studies due to various reasons that were also presented earlier on. As mentioned again earlier on, parents do not want to believe that their children are engaging in sexual activities. And also the adolescents do not want the parents to know that they are engaging in sexual activities. And talking with adolescents about sex is taboo in many cultures and also in many homes. And yet if we look also at the topic of reproductive health, it involves sensitive topics. We're looking at sexual activity, use of contraception, elective termination of pregnancy, HIV infection, and other topics, which include even the usage of PrEP. If we look at the sensitive nature of these topics, they actually complicate the consent process, and they also bring to fore issues of privacy and confidentiality. As a parent, I might actually give consent for my child to participate in research, but then afterwards, I want to know, what were you discussing with these researchers? So they tested you for HIV. I also want to know the results from those tests. And so for one parent to grant permission for their child to participate in an HIV prevention trial, it's actually as good as granting them a sex license. What you are saying is, as a parent, just go ahead and do it. I know you are doing it for whatever reason. Yet we also have to realize that adolescents can make their own decisions. In the previous presentation, you saw there is a large proportion there of household, child-headed households. Here we're looking at children or adolescents who are making mature decisions on behalf of their little ones. They are making decisions in terms of how to use the limited resources at their disposal. But we also hear of adolescents that are making very, very wise investment decisions on the stock exchanges in various countries. And also, as presented earlier on, there might be some challenges in terms of obtaining parental consent, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where there is a lot of migration to cities. And we also have complicated situations where the issues of legal guardianship are not so clear and straight forward. So what then do we need in order to ensure that adolescents participate in HIV prevention research? There is actually the need for flexibility in waiving consent for adolescent HIV research. For me in Zimbabwe, I am a member of a technical committee at the Medicines Control Authority, which is the equivalent of the FDA, where we make decisions about clinical trials. And I see members actually being prepared to make concessions, particularly with regard to the 16 and 17 year olds. But then moving to the lower age groups, there is always a problem. But what we also need here is to empower the adolescents so that they can make decisions about participating in HIV prevention research. There are so many measures that we need to take into consideration. There are issues about revising our laws and our policies by taking reality into consideration. Whenever parliamentarians are meeting to deliberate on these, there are always voices that are against some of these, but we end up having some laws. And once we have such laws, it actually means that our IRBs or our research ethics committees are fully empowered to make decisions about waiving of parental consent. We also want to make sure that our adolescents are educated about research and what it means to be participating in research. We're talking here about mass education, which is aimed at improving research literacy. We're also talking about appropriate counseling so that we reduce the risk to the adolescents. But more importantly also, we're looking at the issues around addressing stigma associated with HIV, because involvement in preventive trials may actually be taken to imply that one is actually engaging in high-risk sexual activity. I like the discussions about tinkering the informed consent so that now you look at some removing some of those difficult inclusion criteria and trying to put in some of the easy ones. So there are some questions that we then need to ask ourselves. Is it ethical to ignore adolescents when we know that they are engaging in unprotected sexual activities? If the answer is no, then something needs to be done. By overprotecting our adolescents, are we not contributing further towards the delay in reaching our target of an AIDS-free generation? What we need to realize is, by involving adolescents, they stand to benefit individually through the various benefits that come through the trials. They also stand to benefit other adolescents now and also in the future, as products are licensed for adolescents in the shortest possible time period. So this actually shortens the product development pathway. And globally, we can achieve the goal of an AIDS-free generation in a much faster way. There are some practicalities that we also need to be thinking about. If we're going to be looking at autonomous participation by adolescents, then we need to demonstrate that they are actually able to make the decisions themselves in terms of granting consent. We could actually be involving some specialists in adolescent issues in our clinical trials so that they can actually assist the trial teams in handling all these issues about our adolescents. And when we look at our community advisory boards, we can also make it a point that we include the youths in the advisory board so that they can also participate in making these decisions on behalf of their own colleagues. But I believe that it's very, very important for HIV prevention trials to be blended together with other HIV prevention activities. That way, we're actually minimizing risks associated with unintentional disclosure of someone's status as a result of participation or as a result of the inclusion or exclusion criteria within a study. So in terms of looking at adolescents' involvement in research, I would like to look at it in the form of a pendulum, where on that extreme end, we're looking at overprotection, and on this extreme end, we're looking at no protection. What we're trying to do is to move from that end where there is overprotection to come to the middle position where there is reasonable protection, which is based on flexibility. Our colleagues in Kenya just released some guidelines for conducting adolescent reproductive health research. These guidelines were released in May this year. And the guidelines clearly state that parental consent can be waived for orphaned or older adolescents who are heading households, for adolescents living in an institution, for pregnant adolescents, for adolescent who is already a parent, or for mature and emancipated minors. The guidelines also state that waiver of parental consent can be granted where parents are inappropriate to grant consent, and they list these populations here. We're looking at lesbians. I got this directly from the guidelines. We're looking at lesbians, we're looking at gays, we're looking at bisexual and transgender, men having sex with men, sex workers, injection drug users, but they also state that it can actually be waived on research on pregnancy prevention or research on adolescents seeking care for STDs. So the question that I would like to pose then is parental consent appropriate for HIV prevention research? If you look at a lot of these behaviors, these are the sensitive behaviors for which parental consent may not be appropriate at the end of the day. In terms of concluding, I'd like to emphasize that the high HIV incidence rates that we have among adolescents make their inclusion in HIV research a public health imperative, one for their own protection, and also two for realizing the goal of an AIDS-free generation. Stakeholders need to come together in creating an enabling framework for the participation of adolescents in HIV research. By including adolescents, we can actually come up with useful data. That is, if the adolescents are approached in the right way. So we are looking here at a complete change of attitude to realize that adolescents can play an important part in fighting HIV. We need to realize that adolescents are tomorrow's adults, and they need to be empowered so that they become responsible for their present and also for their future. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Paul. And what we'd like to do now is ask all the speakers to join us up here. And we have about 35 minutes for discussion. I think what we've heard is a real challenge to think differently about the way we've thought about research and to actually think about the paradigm of the current strategies that are employed to really limit adolescents' participation in research as being unethical, and the overprotection of adolescents currently actually leading to significant harm. And what we'd like to do is provide an opportunity now to have a discussion about how we can move from where we are today to begin to bring regulators and others to a place where there's a broader appreciation of the lost opportunity if we don't change the way we do business. So we'd like to invite questions from the audience, and please state your name and provide the question. Thank you very much. You're the first to the microphone.
Thank you very much. My name is Nadia Samagudu from the Institute of Human Virology in Nigeria. I've really waited very long to have a session like this. I recently wrote a paper, it's still in review, regarding adolescent HIV and access to testing in Africa. A lot of the countries represented here or spoken about are Southern and Eastern African countries. Please do not forget West Africa. I am from Nigeria, and Nigeria has the second largest number of adolescents, estimated number of adolescents living with HIV. Nigeria is not one of the countries included, I'm sorry, I'm very emotional about this, included in the DREAMS initiative, nor the ACT in initiative, and we've basically been a wasteland when it comes to funding for research among children and adolescents. Right now, my new favorite mission is to make sure that we have laws that lower the age of testing, independent testing, B below 18. You cannot do anything in Nigeria if you are below 18. There's no law that really embodies emancipated minors. However, traditionally and culturally, we allow 12, 13, 14-year-old girls to get married. So what I'm just trying to do strategically is to at least ask for a law that collaborates the traditional age of allowing a girl to go to bed with a man when she's 12, 13, 14, to be able to test for HIV on her own. I haven't even started on the research aspect. So I'm just saying, my point here is that do not forget West Africa, and please help us to be able to get to the point where Southern and Eastern Africa, because you guys have really progressed way beyond us. Thank you very much.
Perhaps the one thing I will say is I know WHO is sort of inching towards the notion that we remove all parental assisted consent for HIV testing, but we just recently, a large conglomerate of us addressed the guidelines of the cascade of improving care to try and reduce the losses in the cascade, and that was done within the auspices of the IAPAC network and UNAIDS. And there is an adolescent section there, and quite a few people in the room sort of gave input there, and we quite unashamedly suggested that there should not be the need for parental assisted consent. So, you know, it's mounting, I hear you, that we need to really back Nigeria and other Western African countries in this regard, but we're moving there.
Thank you. Is this on? Oh, hi. I'm Shannon Weber from San Francisco. Thank you. This is an extraordinary group of people, not only in front, but also in the room. It's thrilling to be here with you. It occurs to me that one of the things that impacts our reproductive and sexual agency is violence, and whether that's an experience with trauma in our past, gender-based violence, or our fear of violence based on our sexual orientation or gender identity. And that didn't come up in any of the presentations. And I was really thinking that I think there's this intersection around this experience with violence or the possibility of violence happening to us that intersects with HIV prevention and also reproductive health. And I'm wondering, I think that you guys collectively know so much from your research, but it doesn't end up in the numbers. And if you might speak about that.
So I didn't have my slides, and somebody but I think it's a really important issue. I think it's also important to recognize that all adolescents who are sexually active are not coerced into being sexually active. But I think there's a complex set of things when we think about adolescent risk, which includes gender-based violence, and that also includes violence that young men may experience. So I think I spoke a little bit about sexual reproductive health, but just the issues are much more than HIV prevention, and there are a whole lot of other vulnerabilities, and I support your point about inclusion of gender-based violence. In fact, in the counseling that we do with young people, we talk more broadly about issues and challenges, and the information session is followed up with a counseling session, and we don't call it a pre and post-test counseling, but we just call it a supportive counseling session. And the point of departure in that conversation is really, why are you here? And we find with some kids, it's about experience of violence. With others, it could be fertility control is the dominating factor. And then we weave the other aspects into that counseling session. So it becomes much more therapeutic and more inclusive. And you're locating things that in a contextual manner.
Perhaps I can just add a little to that, that, you know, in our hands, the first encounter that a young woman has is often non-consensual sex, and in fact, as high as, I've seen numbers as high as 25 in some of the work we've done, it's certainly 10-15%. So, you know, that maybe not quite violence, but certainly not a consensual experience. And this raises for me the issue of methods that women can use that are self-controlled. And you know, I was Reve Amico showed some data of a PrEP study we did in Cape Town, and some of the quotes in there are just hair-raising, where women have actually said, the PrEP is so important to me because I know that every day I have a risk of being raped. I mean, you know, that, you know, that just stops you in your tracks, that the reason women are prepared to take a pill every day is because there's a risk that they can actually be sexually assaulted. And unfortunately, this is the situation that we stand in. But I think it really raises the urgency that offering us, you know, saying it again, and I'll say it again, I am tired of offering a 17-year-old girl who's HIV negative in my counseling sessions the male condom. It is just not enough.
To add one more point, it's hard to follow Linda Gale, but for the young men, the young gay and bisexual men that we see, upwards of 40% of them have experienced some type of physical or sexual abuse as children, and oftentimes that's at the hands of the people who are supposed to be taking care of them. And so that, you know, is one of the very explicit reasons that we do not feel comfortable asking our young men to tell their parents that they want to be in a study that has something to do with their sexual orientation, because I think the fear of further traumatizing them and having them become abused is very real. Thanks, Shannon. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Ashley Grosso from Johns Hopkins. Thank you to all the presenters. And on a related topic, there was some talk about the laws restricting age of access to services and parental consent for participation in research. But I wonder if any of you have also faced the barrier of mandatory reporting of abuse, which might include statutory rape, or particularly with youth who sell sex, commercial sexual exploitation, or trafficking, and how those laws and regulations might be a barrier as well.
Yeah, so this is not the work of myself, but we share a wonderful ethics group in KwaZulu-Natal who have given that a lot of thought, and they're under the name of the HIV Ethics Vaccine Group, HAVIG. I forget what the acronym stands for, but Kathy Slack and Anne Strode come from there, and they've written some fantastic stuff. They've helped us a lot with this because, in fact, you know, researchers step forward to say, are we at risk? Do we have liability because we're not reporting mandatory reportable issues? And so what they've helped us to do is to kind of divide these into gray areas and black and white areas and kind of okay areas. And with each of those, we've kind of worked out the scenarios and then said, okay, under these scenarios, the child and the child's protection comes first. So if they're kissing behind the school thing, really, are we going to report this to the police, and how is that going to help this child, you know, really? On the other hand, if they're being exploited, mm-hmm. and by an older person who's then clearly something needs to be done there. I'm not always sure it needs to be reported to the police, but certainly to the social protection agencies, etc. So I think it again, it's about this, there are laws, and some laws are just plain stupid. You know, and you have to say, okay, what are we going to do as a collective in this environment? And then I think it's really useful to have consensus and come up with these kinds of documents that can be shared with IRBs, but can also be shared in the research arena and give you some sort of some meat to work on in that regard. What we have found practically as useful is when a situation comes in where we think social harm might be be happening, we sit and we discuss it as a group. Obviously, being very careful about confidentiality and privacy, because it's important that we all agree and no one does something stupid. And the absolutely guiding principle is the child's protection comes first. And that I think, you know, really kind of sets it apart. And I'm happy to share some of those documents with you for that. That'll be helpful.
Oftentimes we ask, you know, in our surveys, very sensitive information, and sometimes it can be around coerced sex or other types of abuse. One of the things that we often do, because the data, you know, if we do it, for example, in an ACOSI is locked, you know, we can't access that. But we try to implement debriefing interviews after ACOSIs to allow the young person the opportunity to tell us if they were bothered by something, if it triggered something for them, and if they need any additional services. And I think that's one of the important pieces of research, is doing the work in a location where then you can refer immediately that adolescent to somebody who can look after them. But just to be able to ask them how they feel and if that triggered anything for them afterwards.
And just to add to what Sybil said is that in many of the communities where we're working in, there isn't the safety net. So you can have the law say it's mandatory to report X, Y, or Z, but the infrastructure to implement that is not in place. So again, I find the community advisory boards and structures you have that are set up way before you start the research that sort of proxy safety net. So that's the one part of how can you use the community partnerships to address issues, especially if it's within the household. And then the second is, what is the mental state of the individual involved? And if there's suicidal ideation or something like that, you do want to intervene. And that's the only time I think some of the privacy and confidentiality issues need to be revisited and looked at more closely. But so maybe that's some 2 points to think about.
I'd like to pose a question to all of you. Like, it seems that there are things that will take a lot of effort and will take time to change laws, but we shouldn't give up on that. And I'd particularly like to hear Paul's suggestions. You seem exceptionally enlightened for someone in your position, and don't quote me on that. Scratch that. No, I meant what I said, but scratch the way I said it. But how do we get to that place? Maybe I just want more concrete suggestions for what can we do now locally. So as I was writing down some ideas, and I can throw those out, such as, you know, is there any reason we don't have an adolescent member on IRBs? We have someone who has to represent prisoner rights. So maybe their voice needs to be heard during ethics reviews. If there's not a barrier, that seems easy. I really like the peer ambassador idea that Croatia was talking about, and sounded like it was very effective. How do we, you know, is it too far-fetched to think that there's a core definition of mature minor, and that, I forget who brought it up, but this idea that you would have the same age of marriage as age of testing and access of services. That doesn't seem far-fetched, but maybe it's, is that where we should be aspiring to get to, both for research participation, but also for accessing services? So I guess there's several questions embedded in there. You know, what should we do? What can we do now, locally? What should we be, and how should we be trying to change laws, which fundamentally do need to change, because those are really a huge barrier.
Thank you very much. I think there are so many pieces that we can attend to. Some of them can be in the immediate, like, for example, issues of having some youth on the committees, or even involving the youths in the review of our protocols. For example, in our countries where we use external reviewers for reviewing protocols that are submitted to the IRB. But there are also different ways of looking at the issues around involving youth. Some of them it's also about playing around with where you are going to get the youths from, right? So if you can actually satisfy the IRB that you can get them from this particular source, and if they are happy with that, then you get them, you get the go ahead. But I think more importantly, there is need for advocacy in our various countries to make sure that we flag these issues, so that also we end up having laws that make sense. If you look, for example, at the law in South Africa about research, it talks about therapeutic research that for that parental consent can be waived. But now looking at HIV prevention, can you actually put that under therapeutic research? It becomes an issue, but researchers would find a way of tweaking things to make sure that it might fit. But I think it's all about convincing our policymakers so that they realize that there is need for laws that address such. I've realized where there are clear laws, the IRB members would be very, very willing to approve the inclusion of adolescents. Without these, they would always be saying, we have nothing that is supporting our decision. So laws are clearly very, very important, besides the other strategies of ensuring that the voices of the youth are heard.
So while you're ruminating on your answers, I see that Mitchell's at the microphone and wants to help us be a little more granular, I'll bet, on how to identify that low-hanging fruit of things we can work on today.
Sharon, how is it? Are you in my head?
Karmically linked.
Damn. I'm Mitchell Warren. I direct AVAC, and first and foremost want to thank the eight of you for really pulling together all of the right issues. And I did want to go actually exactly where Sharon was going. And I'm just sitting here and thinking both about the huge challenges which you've all identified, and being the rose-colored, glass-wearing optimist of the opportunities that present themselves. And I'd love to hear each of you think a bit about, we will gather in a year's time, hosted by Croatia and fellow Durbanites in Durban for AIDS 2016. We will, in that intervening period, have WHO guidelines about PrEP for all people at risk, which include young people. We will have, because I'm an optimist, very positive results from two wonderfully conducted dapivirine ring studies, thinking about what to do after the studies. And I'm wondering, what should we be doing, not so much around the research settings, as much as how should we be organizing ourselves so that when we're sitting here in a year, we're not thinking about all of the challenges, which won't go away because the stupid laws will still be there. But what should we be looking to be different a year from now? That, because we're not going to overturn laws. I'd like to, but we won't. But what can we do in the next year, thinking about the PrEP guidelines and thinking about dapivirine ring results, to be faster off the mark to try to answer some of these questions? And so it's a daunting task, but I wonder if any of you would comment on some things that we should be thinking about and planning to do now. I was going to pick on Zita, given that you've thought about this a ton, but I'd love to hear some thoughts.
Well, I was thinking before you got up, again, the karmic connection, is that if you think physiologically about a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old, what is different about those three ages? And there's really nothing from the perspective of drug exposure, either oral, vaginal. You can understand 10, 11, 12, there might, clearly could be physiologic differences. But at that age, can you make arguments to the regulators as to why on earth do you have to go down this far? And I think we're already trying to construct that kind of argument with EMA, because it would be really nice to be able to have that in the label so that you don't have to do the research. Now, it doesn't mean that that will translate into different African countries, but at least it could be a start. And I think that there are some really good reasons when you look at the data that has just been presented as to why it should be labeled as such. So I think that that's kind of part of the construct. I mean, to start with the regulatory bodies, you don't really have to do this.
I would agree with Zita, that would make life a hell of a lot easier. I do want to, however, put it out there that I think getting into the field and experiencing it can only help uptake down the line, So earlier on, I was just saying to Zita, and she knows this very well, the kids are so excited about Nuva Ring, because they're like, whoa, this is very cool. Because we have not seen Nuva Rings, This is not something that occurs, and we're practicing Nuva Rings in anticipation of Aspire and the ring study coming through. So, getting it into the hands of these kids purely, even if it is in the research environment. And I agree, it doesn't have to be a randomized controlled trial, and it doesn't need to have an IND, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an opportunity, and we can learn lots. We can learn how we'll market it for them. We'll learn how they make choices. We'll learn, how much uptake there will be, how hard we'll have to work, how adherent they'll be. Are there other kind of cool things we can do around the adherence piece? So I'd actually not make an argument to do less. I'd make an argument to do more research, but really to try and move towards being able to do it free of the parental consent. I think 110, 130, I always forget which one is which, the younger one. That is gold, you know, where you can actually say you don't need parents, but when you can bring your parents in, that's really cool. My experience in Plus Pills now is that we actually had, and in fact, it wasn't our IRB and it wasn't our regulator, it was actually our sponsor who wanted us to have parental consent. And actually, it's really cool that some parents are very behind their adolescent girls and they're saying, we really want to help you prevent yourself from getting HIV. Not only do I want you to take part, but I'm actually going to give you this pill every single day, which kind of speaks to autonomy in a very different way. But the bottom line is I like the notion that where it works, you're facilitating, you know, parent-child conversations, but where it doesn't work, you don't need it. And that, to me, is fantastic.
I agree, Linda Gill. I think that the option of involving parents and communities of parents when they are supportive and it can be constructive is invaluable. I think that that's ultimately, you know, who...
way we want to go.
Right. It's ultimately the way we want to go and would really probably help make the most impact for that young person in their lives as well. I think, you know, Mitchell, to your question, it sounds cliche. We've talked about, you know, we need to have adolescents on advisory boards and IRBs and things like that. You know, I've been to 4 or 5 meetings so far in this IAS, and I haven't seen a teenager yet, even though we've been discussing teenagers and
lots of German. Yes. I promise you.
I hope so. I hope so, because 25-year-olds are not teenagers.
Yeah.
So we do need to remember that as well and really push ourselves a little bit harder too.
Yeah, I very much agree. We don't have advocacy for youth, by youth, which is against everything we always say, for us, by us, and we have forgotten that whole piece. And so we are, in a way, as paternalistic as the research bodies that we've been railing against, in as much as we haven't really brought them forward. I mean, Katie, you might want to mention, like, the young women I know enrolling in 023 are wildly excited about being part of this, wildly interested in the new technology, and I think if I remember correctly, the Pitt IRB actually prohibits teen girls from recruiting other teens for this study because it might out them as sexually active. And so there's this crazy disconnect of paternalism, which actually has prevented the 023 team from invoking that advocacy of teens for teens, which I think is criminal.
Agreed.
Yeah. Though I will add that at the other sites, not Pittsburgh, but at the other sites, there has been a lot of participant referral and chatter amongst the participants. But our IRB is particularly conservative, and they were concerned that it would breach the confidentiality of our participants, which is a shame. But, you know, I don't think it's just the IRBs that are so paternalistic. It's also the people holding the health fair and the community who just don't want to really align themselves with a reproductive health study because it's viewed as being promoting sex, or potentially maybe they know that it's a really good study, but they're afraid that the community members might see it and construe it as promoting sex. So it's there is a lot of paternalism, I think, not just with the IRBs.
So I just wanted to add on a couple of concrete things. So the first is this disconnect between research and access to services. And I think we need to use that space a lot more creatively. And so if we can contextualize firstly, the recognition of risk, because that's really important for adherence. And we have a few early adopters, instant adopters, but by and large, young people see themselves as invincible. Mm. I mean, that's the mark of adolescence. You think there's nothing that can make you vulnerable. So it's changing that and using the space of service provision, particularly testing services, et cetera, to work on that. I think advocacy efforts need to be expanded. Advocacy efforts generally have been taking a knock in the current financial climate, and we got to, one, strengthen our advocacy efforts, and two, is ensure we're including the voices of everybody. So it's the whole thing about nobody gets left behind, and yet that's a group being left behind. And my last point is that recently when Uganda was passing laws around same-sex relationships, the IOM partnered with local science academies to put out a really excellent document that's being used as an important tool at multiple levels. And maybe it's time to really gather some pivotal documents that show adolescents are the future, this is the vulnerabilities, and how do we maximize on that?
Bill?
So excellent set of presentations and really, really stimulating discussion. Bill Capogiannis, by the way, from NICHD. I mean, I think that the one comment that kind of made me, I want to sort of first just make the statement that, and I think folks, and particularly Paul, I think you alluded to this, we really need to focus, to bring the focus on protecting adolescents with and not from research. And I think, you know, as a Fed, I feel kind of awkward saying that, but I think it's very important, and I agree with Linda Gale, your points about, you know, it is very important. When I engaged FDA, we at NICHD engaged FDA around the discussions on the ATN 113 study, the premise or the foundational argument wasn't that we need adolescents because there's a biological difference that is going to be so profound, we need to find out what the issues are here. I mean, yes, there were some sort of, I think, more peripheral safety issues around the tenofovir and growing bones and some things, but there were a lot of other, I think, legitimate contextual concerns, specifically around things that were emanating around IPREX and adherence at that time, and you know, risk compensation and even the IRB regulatory. So part of the pre-IND consultation that we did, we got back, you know, we understand this and we know that all of these contextual variables are very important and we're going to need to understand more about them. And it would be nice if you considered A, B, C, and D in your studies. And I think that went into the design, and, you know, we had a lot of rich information that is still being analyzed, some of which has been started to come out in terms of sort of the IRB process evaluation piece, for example. And I think it is, for those kinds of reasons, it's very important because we have to keep in mind the contextual pieces and how these youth will use these preventive interventions, not just this one, but then the next one. And then a lot of them are going to be product specific. So there isn't, I think, going to be the ability to just have one discussion and say, we're done with this. There are going to be multiple different products and platforms and things, and there has to be, I think, a real ability to engage the regulators, the FDA, for example, in my context, to be able to have these discussions and kind of have it a real dialogue back and forth instead of kind of trying to guess what they might want or what they might not or what they might, you know. I think it's much more time well spent planning ahead and then trying to anticipate how to do this in a much more proactive way. So that's my two cents. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I think we're going to do one more question, and then we'll sum up.
Hi, I'm Audrey Bruzek. I'm from the University of Washington, and I'm an adolescent. I just turned 20, and I'm kind of sad to see that I'm probably the youngest person at this conference, and there's not many people in my age group. But something I would like to ask you all to do is to bring adolescents into research and really mentor girls and all over the world. And I had an amazing opportunity to attend this conference, and I've had an amazing time, and I've learned so much. And I hope that next year, all of you guys can bring an adolescent to the conference and give them the same kind of experience that I've had this year. So, thank you.
Well, as always, I think we could have used a lot more time, and this is a conversation that needs to keep going. I found myself really disturbed hearing how much variability there is with IRBs, and do we have to live with that? I mean,
no.
And what can we do with it? I think as individual researchers, we sometimes just, you know, we get beaten down a little bit by it, and I think that we need to think about ways. Maybe it starts with really trying to get an adolescent on the IRBs and also doing more education to IRBs, because they do turn over, and they may, you know, I think we assume too often that people know how urgent this issue is, but we have some education work to do, and on so many levels, including on the larger level, to try to break through some of the denial and resistance to accepting the fact that young people are sexually active, and we need to help them do that safely. So I guess I want to thank those who've been here and who've done a great job at presenting, and thank you for doing such a great job in spite of the technological issues, particularly Croatia. And I just feel like it's an evening, and we've lined up a stellar group of people who presented, and we should continue to not make this a one-off discussion, but let's try to collectively come up with concrete actions.
I also want to thank Lisa Rossi, who was instrumental in pulling all of this together and put together the little postcard and the bios and brought everyone together tonight. And there's really excellent news in that there are adult beverages and food outside
and
for
no
those of you,
and no
consent required. And we'll have a little roped off area just outside to the right. And some of the refreshments have been provided to us by AVAC. So since we couldn't use NIH funds for that, but just to be completely clear, and I'd like to just give anyone else a last chance to say anything in summary.
I feel compelled to say, as a member of the IAS, that we have really heard that there need to be youth voices at Durban 2016. And I'm very excited to tell you that it's already started. There are dialogues happening. Admittedly, they're happening in Africa, but we're looking at ways to bring youth not only to those dialogues, and we've already had the first, but to many more. 300 adolescents collected on the 16th of June in Durban and had a fantastic conversation. We heard what they wanted to hear. We're going to keep doing that. MAC Fund has given us a wonderful grant to actually bring youth voices to Durban. And by youth, I don't mean 25-year-old. I mean 11 to, you know, 20-year-old. And so I think, you know, it's going to be terrific to see young people there. We've even mooted that a symposium will be run by adolescents for adolescents with no adults in the room. So we're looking forward to seeing that. So I just want to reassure you, and, you know, I'm really sad that you're the 20-year-old in the room, but delighted at the same time. I feel sad for all of us. But the good news is you brought the average age of the room down extraordinarily. Thank you for speaking.
All right, let's meet outside and enjoy an adult beverage. Thank you.